I'm Andrew Schwartz, and you're listening to The Truth of the Matter, a podcast by CSIS where we break down the top policy issues of the day and talk with the people that can help us best understand what's really going on. To get to the truth of the matter about the upcoming visit of Japanese Prime Minister Kishida and the upcoming visit of the Philippines President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. to the United States in April, we have with us one of my great colleagues, Chris Johnstone, who is a senior advisor at CSIS, and he's also the Japan chair. So he's the perfect person to talk about this series of events that are happening in Washington next week. Chris, first, let me ask you, what are the key objectives of the upcoming summit? I know initially it was a bilateral state visit, and I believe it's still a state visit with Prime Minister Kishida of Japan, but the Philippines president is also coming now. So what happened here, and should we talk about these as two separate visits or as one thing, you know, holistically?
Andrew, great to be here. Thanks for having me. And I would say they're separate, but they're connected. We should think of them that way. So first, on the bilateral meeting with Kishida, you know, this is a state visit. It's a big deal in diplomatic terms.
Sure.
The president, the White House only hands out one or two of these a year. They do them for their closest friends. And so for Kishida, this is the first time a Japanese prime minister has come to Washington as a state visitor since 2015. And it reflects really the historic strength of the relationship, the big changes that Kishida announced as part of Japan's national security strategy back in 2022, increasing defense spending, investing in new capabilities, cooperating on Ukraine, working with us on economic security issues related to China. Pretty vast agenda, and we're really, I think, remarkably aligned. So this visit is first and foremost about sort of honoring and acknowledging all of that at a time when politics for both leaders, I think it's fair to say, is a little bit uncertain at best.
Well, so this brings me to my question, Chris, about the Japanese. The Japanese are traditionally a people that, you know, don't want to be embarrassed about anything. And is this embarrassing to them that this trilateral was tacked on, or are they okay with it?
No, I think it's seen as a good thing. So first of all, Kishida will get all the bells and whistles of a bilateral visit. He'll have the meeting in the Oval Office with the president. He's going to give a speech to Congress. We should probably talk about that. There'll be a bilateral press conference. He's going to North Carolina to visit a prospective EV battery factory that Toyota is going to be building. So he's got a lot of bilateral stuff that I think will really be on display.
So we're still showing him the love.
We're still showing him the love. The thing about the Philippines, this is, I think, the best example of the Biden administration's success in trying to build a networked security architecture in East Asia. Nobody thought that we would be making the kind of progress with the Philippines that we've been making under President Marcos. It was a very difficult period under President Duterte. Turned a corner completely with the election of Marcos. He was just in Washington a few months ago for his own visit to the White House. So the chance for these three leaders, I believe for the first time, to sit together in the Oval Office, talk trilaterally about cooperation, it's a great, I think, symbol of president's strategy that is focused first on strengthening the bilateral alliances that we have, but then stitching them together in new minilateral ways.
Okay, we'll talk about the trilateral meetings and what the United States hopes to get out of it and what the Philippines and Japan hope to get out of it. But first and foremost, let's go to the bilateral. So what are the major areas of policy to be discussed between Prime Minister Kishida and President Biden?
So I think the deliverables this time are going to be, they're going to reflect a combination of sort of consolidation and operationalization. What I mean by that is it's less on grand, big statements of strategic intent, because the countries are aligned on most things. It's more about putting in place the pieces to actually turn that alignment into action. So you're going to see a host of deliverables in the defense space, in outer space cooperation, and on economic issues. On the defense side, there will be, I think, a statement of intent to modernize the command structure of the U.S.-Japan alliance, modernize the structure of U.S. forces in Japan, modernize and bring together the relationship at the command level with Japan. You will see announcements related to strengthening defense industrial cooperation. Japan may expand its production line of Patriot missiles, for example, in a way that benefits both of us. initiatives to allow some maintenance of our defense equipment to take place in Japan and not in the United States to save us money. This stuff seems small, but it's all about, this is about bringing credibility and operational reality to the U.S.-Japan alliance. It's pretty important.
So, Chris, I got to ask you, everybody's been talking about Nippon Steel recently and its attempts to buy U.S. steel. We talk about this on my other podcast, The Trade Guys, all the time. What's your take here? Will the Biden administration put pressure on Kishida regarding this deal?
This is a thorny issue. This is the issue that is going to loom in the background of this visit. I think both leaders will do everything they can to avoid raising it. I think the purpose of the president's statement when he made it was to get it out of the way so it wouldn't have to be on the agenda during the summit. Kishida certainly has no interest in stirring the pot himself. But I think what this issue does, though, is it really pokes at Japanese anxieties about the trajectory of U.S. politics, right? For all the good news on the alliance front, and there's a lot of it as I've gone through, I think the Achilles heel of the administration is the international economic policy part. And there are times when that alliance agenda and that international economic agenda come into tension. And Nippon Steel is a great example of that. It's hard to square that circle. So Kishida will avoid the topic. He may well be asked about it in the Rose Garden at the press conference. May not be able to avoid it entirely, but it looms in the background.
Why is it so thorny?
For the United States, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, clearly this is an example where domestic politics trumps sensible economic policy, in my view.
Right. After all, this is U.S. Steel. You know, even if people don't know exactly what U.S. Steel does these days, they know the name U.S. Steel. It's one of the great brand names there.
That's right. It's one of the great brand names, goes back to the Carnegie era, all of that. It's sort of a symbolic company. And so, you know, there's a visceral reaction among some to a foreign company potentially taking over U.S. Steel. But in my view, opposing it would be counter to U.S. interests, actually, in the long run.
How so?
Well, I think ultimately U.S. Steel is likely to bring more technology and support and invest more and employ more workers than the status quo. So it seems to me that this is a transaction that should go forward. But at a minimum, the CFIUS process should have been, in my view, allowed to play out. And the fact that the White House felt the need to comment about this transaction now really speaks to the sensitivity of domestic politics around issues like this.
Yeah, it's hard to think of any issue anymore that doesn't have sensitive politics around it, but that's interesting. Nippon Steel, we'll have to watch that one. So let's talk about Japan's increasing military capabilities and its collaboration with the U.S. How will both nations further cooperate to counter China's growing military influence in the Indo-Pacific region?
That is part of what this potential deliverable of an announcement of restructuring the command and control of the U.S.-Japan alliance is all about. I mean, I think the point to make here is historically, you know, in the Korean Peninsula, we have a true operational military alliance with a combined command, a single commander, deep integration of our forces, an ability, as they say, to fight tonight if they have to. We have nothing of that history in the U.S.-Japan relationship. For decades, Japan was really just a platform for U.S. military operations, and there wasn't much focus on what would we do militarily with Japan. Well, that's been changing for a while, began to change really under Abe, as Japan made some legislative changes, and it's accelerated under Kishida with this new defense budget, investments in new capabilities. So now the next step is, how do we make our alliance more truly operational so that we can operate together on a day-to-day basis in a seamless way, peacetime to contingency? And I think that's where there really is an urgent need to rethink the command and control of U.S. forces in Japan and counterparts in the Japanese system to enable us to work more closely together. So I think we're headed. We won't get an announcement of a final vision in this leaders meeting, but we'll get pointed in the direction that the two leaders want to go. And then DOD and other parts of the U.S. government will pick it up and begin to develop a real future concept for how U.S. forces at the command level, Japanese forces at the command level interact.
So this is truly an important moment in the U.S.-Japan relationship in terms of our collective defense.
potentially a very significant moment, because it would make the U.S.-Japan alliance far more credible, far more responsive, and in that sense, contribute to deterrence, right? The less of a sense that there's weakness or uncertainty in how the alliance would respond to a contingency, much more sense that the U.S. and Japan would truly be stitched together and able to respond.
So while they're navigating that, how is Japan navigating its semiconductor industry, and what forms of support is it receiving from the United States to further the industry, you know, as opposed to the United States trying to cut China off from the industry?
Yeah, Japan has been a close partner with us on the technology protection and promotion front. They worked closely with us in developing the export control measures on semiconductor and semiconductor equipment that were imposed on China a couple of years ago. They have their own, like our CHIPS Act, they have their own version of that where they're providing subsidies to their own firms to build more semiconductors at home. I think the issue for the future, and I think the leaders will talk about this, is how do we avoid a race to the bottom where all of us are subsidizing our own industries and we end up competing with each other and cannibalizing each other? I think there's an effort, and we may see it coming out of this summit, to develop some rules of the road, some common practices for how we're going to protect and promote key industries like semiconductors. And I think that will be definitely part of the discussion at the White House.
All right, Chris, let's talk about the trilateral nature of this upcoming visit. What role does this trilateral summit play in shaping the broader geopolitical dynamics of the region?
Here's the thing. This idea of networking U.S. alliances in Asia, not new. I think I wrote that in a slide in the bowels of the Department of Defense around 2012.
Definitely not new.
Not new. So, but it wasn't real. It hasn't been real, right? We've given a lot of lip service to networking, connecting our alliances. What's happening now is organically, these alliances, especially the alliance with the U.S., with Japan, South Korea, Australia, and the Philippines, all getting stronger at the same time. First time, I believe, that's been the case since the end of the Cold War. And why are they getting stronger at the same time? Because all these countries share common concerns about that big country to the west, China.
The big red country.
Right, right. So this is the region responding to Chinese revisionism. And the latest form of this is the Philippines, and the Philippines' interest in a much stronger relationship with Washington, and also a much stronger relationship with Japan. Japan's developing its own bilateral defense relationship with the Philippines too. And that's, I think, very positive from the standpoint of deterrence and from the U.S., from the standpoint of the U.S. position in the region.
So what are some of the initiatives we may see come from this summit that would diminish Chinese influence in the region?
I think what you'll see is a number of defense-related things that are announced, perhaps an announcement. One thing I'll be watching for, an announcement on joint patrols, joint exercises in the South China Sea, for example. Another thing I'll be watching for is whether there's progress announced on Japan's negotiations of an access agreement with the Philippines. I also think you'll see some things on the economic side, perhaps some new cooperation related to critical minerals and supply chain resilience. So I think they'll hit both ends of the spectrum there, and it should be quite significant. And I think just the meeting itself, those three leaders at the White House, very, very symbolic of what's happening in the region.
And sends a strong message, doesn't it?
Sends a very strong message.
All right. So, Chris, if there was one major policy or diplomatic action you'd like to see coming out of either the U.S.-Japan bilat or this trilateral summit, what would it be and why?
Well, the first thing I would love to see an acceleration of this cooperation on defense, especially this command restructuring. I think that would be a sign that momentum in the bilateral alliance is continuing, even though both countries have domestic politics that's complicated. And with the Philippines, what I would love to see is tangible progress on Japan's own defense agreements with the Philippines. The United States has this thing called EDCA, which gives us regular access and opportunities to train. The Philippines and Japan were also able to conclude an agreement. That would really put a real foundation under trilateral cooperation that's more than just a meeting.
Chris, this is really helpful. Thank you so much. We'll be watching for some of these outcomes in the week to come. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Andrew. It's been a pleasure.
If you enjoyed this podcast, check out our larger suite of CSIS podcasts. From Into Africa, The Asia Chessboard, China Power, AIDS 2020, The Trade Guys, Smart Women, Smart Power, and more. You can listen to them all on major streaming platforms like iTunes and Spotify. Visit csis.org/podcasts to see our full catalog